Welcome to the Austin Therapy Podcast. I'm Kate. I have a background in psychology, and I'm joined by
Teresa, and I have a background in social work.
And today, we are talking about episode 2 of the 1995 Pride and Prejudice miniseries. Yay!
Before we start on it, I just want to say I had a very Janeite moment in my life today. I went to the used bookstore. I was looking at the book. You know, it was on the shelf and I almost bought it, but then I didn't want to have to bring it home with me because we're not going to read it for a while. Death at Pemberley.
Death comes to Pemberley.
Yeah. I carried around the store with me for a little while and was like, I'm going to get this. And then I was like, this is a hardcover book that I'm not going to read probably for another like 4 years. Why am I buying this now? But anyways, I had that impulse.
You wanted to collect it.
But buying it here where I will only be for 2 more months, not my smartest move. So I didn't buy it.
I mean, I'm going to throw it out there for you that if you want to read some of the Pride and Prejudice material that people have made that is like Pride and Protest is coming out, and there's quite a few like queer versions of Pride and Prejudice, just lots of like fun takes on it. We're not going to do all of them. So feel free at any time to pick up a book related to Jane Austen that's not Jane Austen and read it.
Okay. Well, I will keep that in mind.
Because I haven't read a lot of those. So at a certain point, we'll just be doing a book podcast.
Ooh, maybe that'll be the flip of it. It'll be books that I've read that you have not.
There you go.
Except for I have a horrible memory and will remember none of it.
I mean, I do too. The only reason I remember Jane Austen stuff is because I have read them more than 2 dozen times.
Fair enough.
It took a lot for it to get in there. And even then, I'm like, I don't remember. Anyways,
into the episode.
So, Teresa, what did you think of episode 2?
I, very early into it, when I realized that Collins was coming into the picture, I wrote down, I'm going to hate this episode. And it's not wrong.
Yeah, it's a hard episode.
It is a very Collins and Wickham heavy episode. And I will say, if I was still a novice and didn't know what happens in the book and knew nothing, Wickham wouldn't bother me so much. But because it's so heavy on Collins and Wickham in this together, I'm like, this is just the villain episode.
Wickham wasn't pissing me off in this episode, actually. I found Elizabeth was pissing me off in this episode.
I don't think I got pissed off by Lizzie. I actually don't think I got pissed off by Wickham. Actually, like, in this adaptation, in this episode, he is actually kind of endearing and you don't want to hate him. Because I know what I know, I hate him.
Right. He's the charmer that he's supposed to be.
Exactly. I know he gets worse, so I wasn't super mad at him in this episode, but I just think like the combo of him and Collins together in one episode is just a lot. It's a lot of energy. It's a lot of go away, mostly directed at Collins, if I'm honest. And part of me is like, how much time in this episode do we spend on me being like, I hate Collins? Because I do feel like I spend a lot of our episodes just complaining about the characters I don't like.
I think most people dislike Collins, so it's okay.
Okay, great.
You're not like ragging on characters that people love.
It's true. I think I generally am in the consensus with people's hatred so far.
Yeah. What did you think of this Mr. Collins compared to the movie Mr. Collins? Compared to the book Mr. Collins?
So there were a couple interesting things that happened. First off, I will say Mrs. Bennet drives me nuts in this episode. And again, I think it's that she's so overdone, which we talked about last time, that they've just dialed her annoyance up to like 150. So when Mr. Bennet is announcing that Mr. Collins is coming and she's like, oh, don't talk about that odious man. I was like, oh, damn, here's something I agree with Mrs. Bennet about. He is an odious man. I dislike him very strongly. Granted, her tune changes when he comes and is like, I'm going to marry one of your daughters. But her initial reaction to him, I'm like, I mean, she's not wrong. He is kind of horrible. So it was one moment where I was like, oh, I kind of like Mrs. Bennet in this episode. It was a very fleeting moment. So what do I think of the Collins in this episode, though? There's the moment where like Mr. Bennett starts reading the letter, and then we switch over to Collins reading the letter and little montage-y of his life. And I can't remember a single word that was in that letter because I can't process anything he says in this episode ever. He starts talking and my brain just like, I don't know if it's a static going on in there that anything he says or like any of his long monologues, it all goes in one ear and out the other. I don't even know if it goes in one ear. I just tune it out.
So compared to the 2005, this one's more annoying?
I think annoying in a different way.
Okay.
I think the 2005 one feels more insistent, maybe is the word I want to use. A little bit more abrasive.
Mm.
This one feels truer to how I think he was probably portrayed in the book. Like really annoying, really awkward, really unlikable, but not quite as abrasive.
Okay.
What do you think the difference is? Do you feel a difference?
I think in the 2005 adaptation, they try and make him more forgivable.
Hmm.
That he actually has feelings for Lizzie. And, you know, you remember the scene in 2005 where he's got the little flower and he's disappointed that he can't find Lizzie?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like little things like that. And maybe because he doesn't take up as much screen time, because this felt like a full episode of Collins.
It was a full episode of Collins. It was a full hour of Collins.
The 2005 feels less annoying, which also, you know, the pacing just means we get through Collins much faster,
which is maybe a nice thing. I will say, interestingly, this version and the 2005 version both play that angle of like, Mary and Collins would actually be a good match. They almost play up a Mary being really interested in Collins, which what I will say is that this version of Collins and this version of Mary, I kind of see it.
Okay. You can see these two liking each other.
I can see why Mary likes him.
Right.
And I think if they ended up together, it would not be an unhappy marriage versus the 2005 one. They still felt very mismatched. This one feels a little bit more matched. Not that it's an ideal match. I don't think anyone with Collins is an ideal match, but I kind of get it from Mary's perspective a little bit, at least this version of Mary.
Yeah. And I kind of wonder if the 2005 took their cue from this one.
They might have, yeah.
Just became so much of the fandom.
Mm-hmm. And I did find this one definitely plays up how much all the other sisters hate Collins. It seems like everyone really dislikes him. I don't feel like that's as present in the 2005 or even in the book that Kitty and Lydia are like, dear Lord, hide ourselves.
No, that's pretty accurate to the book.
You think so? I guess maybe I just don't remember it, but
that's pretty accurate to the book. Yeah. Because there's the scene where he's reading Fordyce's sermons and Lydia basically interrupts to be like, this is boring.
Oh, I have zero memory of this.
And is like super rude about it. And I remember your reaction was, I don't agree with Lydia on many things, but I agree with her on this.
I mean, that's probably true.
So, no, there was a pretty feeling across the board in the house that Collins was annoying.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad that that is a well-known fact amongst all of them, except for apparently Mrs. Bennett, who's just annoying and stupid.
And then Mary, who moralizes.
Yes. And then there was also this moment, and it happened twice. It's as if they're playing Mr. Collins to be sick in this, that he's dying or something. I don't know. There was something about when they walk to town and his whole like, Cousin Lizzie, do me the honor. Nah, made me feel gross. But they're walking to town and they're walking over this bridge and he's like saying something and Lizzie gives him some response. And then it just looks like he's choking. And I didn't understand it. But then also later, after she turns down his proposal, looks again like he's dying. And I'm like, I just don't understand this acting choice or this like storyline choice here.
So the part over the bridge is showing that he's out of shape compared to them.
Mm.
The reason that I particularly tuned into it was because when they're walking over the bridge, he is like out of breath.
Right.
as he's asking his questions. So that's basically, I think they're trying to show this incompatibility, like he can't keep up with Lizzie.
So they're trying to show that in multiple realms of he can't keep up with her intellectually, physically, emotionally, like any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. It just struck me as a little bit as weird. And I thought that that might be the implication of it, but it just felt, maybe it's that everything's dialed up to 10. So it just felt a little overly dramatic. Yeah. It was just weird.
Okay.
And then we get to town, and in that moment, I was like, I actually don't know which one of these actors is Lydia and which one's Kitty. I can't tell them apart. I don't know who's who. And I continued through the entire episode having a really hard time telling Lydia and Kitty apart.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that will be a little bit more solidified the further we get into things.
I think it definitely will. I think part of it is it's been probably a month since we watched the first episode where I didn't necessarily feel like I had that confusion. But in this episode in particular, Lydia and Kitty are often together and often giving a very similar energy that like they're kind of interchangeable in this episode.
And I think that that does speak to kind of the book where Lydia and Kitty were always like said in the same sentence, and that they were much more like annoying sister background characters. And it's not till we get further in that you start to realize that Lydia is this more prominent character that we need to pay attention to, and the separation happens.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I think that's a good device if that's what was intended. I also think like I'm hindered because we're watching these episodes a little bit further apart and my memory's not that great for faces. But we get to town, and I thought I caught this, but now as I'm like sitting here, I'm like, maybe I didn't catch this. Does Denny introduce Wickham as Lord Wickham?
No, I don't. Now I want to go back and watch the scene again.
I should have rewatched it to know. There was just this moment where I was like, wait, did he just say Lord Wickham? I'm so confused. I was like, he's definitely not a lord. That would be very weird. And what's Wickham's first name? I can't even think of it now.
George.
Oh, maybe it was George. Maybe he said, this is my friend George Wickham. And I heard Lord Wickham.
That's fair.
That's not unlikely. Okay, that makes much more sense than me being like, I'm so confused. How did he become a lord in this adaptation, but also joining the military?
Yeah. George Wickham.
Okay.
What did you think of Wickham?
I thought he was more attractive than the 2005 version in a way that feels maybe more subtle. Like, I think the 2005 adaptation tries to make him vastly different from the other men in the militia versus this one. Like, you know who Wickham is, but it's not like he is completely left field doing something entirely different than the rest of the militia men are doing with their hair, with the way that they're carrying themselves, things like that.
I feel like this version, the interaction between Lizzie and Wickham makes so much more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2005 version, he seems very closed off. And it's like they tried to lean into him being mysterious or something, and they missed it because he just seems really closed off.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this one, you get the sense of his charm.
Yes.
I'm not going to say that I understand, but I understand why Lizzie's drawn to this guy.
Well, and I wrote down that he doesn't feel as slippery in this episode. He at least portrays himself as genuine in this episode, which is how it is in the book too, right? Like, Lizzie takes him quite genuinely, and kind of as he's written, as we know, like, that is part of his charm, is that you take him to be genuine. And I think part of me watching this adaptation wondered a little bit if Wickham truly believes what he says.
Right.
He is being genuine because it is his experience and his story.
And I think that that's really common for abusive individuals to rewrite things so that they're the victim of the narrative,
mm-hmm.
even when they know it's not true. And then that conflict sometimes is what would come out if this person were to go to therapy and work on it. There is something where the story doesn't
actually align because they're only ever putting themselves in the position of victimhood.
Mm.
But the issue really is that they've told that story to themselves so many times that they actually believe it.
Yeah. And I think that the way he tells the story about his experience with Darcy, I genuinely believe this version believes that that's what's happened.
Right. He thinks that Darcy's doing the things against him that he's doing because he resents him.
Well, because he resents him and because Darcy is just a mean, horrible human.
Right.
Right. Like he has written his life story to make Darcy the villain, and he truly believes that.
Likely, there's a lot of projection that's happening because he's the one who is actually jealous of Darcy, and all of the things that he is saying that he dislikes in Darcy are probably things that he actually genuinely dislikes about himself.
Oh, most definitely. That would not surprise me in the least. And I don't think, knowing what we know about Wickham as a character, like if I was to write the Wickham story post Pride and Prejudice, I don't actually think that ever changes because he doesn't strike me as the type of person who would want to change.
No. Well, and how would that serve him if he were ever not the victim?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has tied his identity to being a victim.
But I think that also the fact that he has that charm and can spin that tale is also very much the pattern that we see with certain individuals and how they hook people into the experience of being like their flying monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a charming guy who can tell a charming story, and you believe him without any other information.
Yeah, and I wrote down that he's a bit of a chameleon also. And the moment that I realized that was he's, you know, talking to Lizzie about quite serious things, you know, his life experience. And then Lydia comes along and wants to, like, spend time with him and dance. And he changes his engagement and is able to navigate and express himself in a way that is appealing and engaging for Lydia that would not be the same for Lizzie. So he is an excellent con man.
Well, and I was watching him and he never actually tells a full lie.
Yeah.
And so when he approaches Lizzie, he says, oh, I didn't think I would be able to get myself away from your sisters, your younger sisters. And she's like, oh, yes, they're quite a handful. And he jumps over saying something to disagree with Lizzie and says, ah, oh, but they're sweet girls. And knowing what happens, that sort of evasiveness while also seeming to agree with Lizzie. It's when you see people like Wickham who are probably degenerate gamblers. He doesn't think or care about anybody else's perspective. He always sees himself as the victim in every scenario. And then you see them do things and navigate things that way. It's hard to decide if they're really smart, manipulative people or just really lucky, dumb people. Like, was he actually thinking about evading in that moment and evading the answer while also agreeing with her? I don't know. There's such a creepy level in that conversation, specifically later on when he talks about, is it like Miss Darcy and that she's 16, the same age as Lydia? And Lizzie's like, she's 15. And he's like, oh, it's like you. I don't know. There were just many layers to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me think about, so I really love the show The Good Place. And there's a line in there, and I won't know it word for word, but it's something along the lines of a lie is more convincing the closer it is to the truth, which I think is what Wickham does really well. Is I actually don't think he's always lying. I think he is maybe bending the truth. He is maybe spinning the story in a way that places him in a better light. And so I think that effectively allows him to be quite an effective con man.
I don't actually think he's an effective con man. I actually think that he's quite bad at it.
He's just fallen into a circumstance in Hertfordshire where everybody already hates his target.
Okay, I could see that, yeah. I guess I think about how we hear about Lydia and Wickham kind of in the like epilogue-y end chapter of the book where they seem to be able to get along somewhere for a short time and then have to move on because, you know, all his lies have come crashing down around him. So maybe he's not effective in the long term, but I do think he probably does the same thing over and over in many places and can get along for a short term.
He has short term charm because there is, I think it's in the book where they talk about discharging all of his debts. And it turns out he was also sleeping with a whole bunch of his friends' wives.
Mm-hmm.
And he is that short term fun guy. This is, again, where it's like, is he actually smart? Could he use these skills to his benefit? No, he continuously shoots himself in the foot.
Right. Well, and maybe some of that is he's deeply selfish and short-sighted on these things. Because you can be selfish and long-sighted and be able to do a long-term con versus he wants the instant gratification for himself.
Yes. And I think very much he... as someone who thinks he deserves these things and that he doesn't actually feel bad when things come crashing down and it feeds into his victim story.
I mean, I don't hate him in this episode. Like, I think he's quite well played in this.
Yeah.
I think he is exactly who he needs to be in this moment in time in this story.
Can I talk about why I hated Lizzie?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Watching it being like, oh my God, Lizzie, what the fuck? Because Wickham spins his tale of like Darcy being the bad guy. And Lizzie goes home and tells Jane. And Jane's like, oh my God, but do you think it's actually true? And Lizzie's like, of course it is. He told it so genuinely. And that's all the proof she uses is that this guy that I met today must be super charming. And I get that in the books, I think there's a little bit more space between meeting him and telling the story, but there's not much. And that's the only proof that she uses. And she's very adamant. And then she tells this story later on to Charlotte at the ball. And Charlotte's like, but seriously, do you think this is true? And Lizzie's like, of course it is. How could we think otherwise? Why would he make such outrageous claims? And it never clicked for her that maybe he is making these outrageous claims because he's done more outrageous things than these claims. Compared to what he's actually done, this is not that bad. What he's telling is not a full truth and not actually, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, Lizzie fails to heed the warnings from multiple people. Even Carolyn Bingley is like, yeah, that guy's kind of an asshole, but I've heard you like him. Why? And I don't like Carolyn in any sense, but I had this moment of like, damn, even Carolyn's trying to warn her off of him.
And I get that that's accurate to the book, but it was just so many instances.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to like tell Lizzie to wake up.
Well, and it is interesting when I think about Lizzie as a character of being very independent and speaking her mind and doing what she thinks is right and best. But there's also this part of it of two of her closest confidants are telling her, like, take that with a grain of salt. Like, let's think about this a little bit more. And she just barrels ahead without considering their opinions, which I don't necessarily know if I know how to reconcile that with Lizzie as a character as a whole.
It's an interesting level of trust. And I think, you know, if we're going to lean into things, this episode really highlighted Lizzie's prejudice.
Mm.
It feels like when you don't know the story that it's highlighting Darcy's pride, right? It feels like that's what the story's trying to tell you. But once you've read the books, you're like, no, this episode highlights Lizzie's prejudice. Sometimes not for bad. Like, it's okay to be prejudiced around someone like Mr. Collins, who continues to verify the thoughts you have about him. But the reason that she likes Wickham is because he dislikes Darcy, and so does she.
Yeah, she's formed an alliance over mutual hate.
Yeah.
Which, granted, I will say, I've formed many alliances like that, and some of my very good friends I remain very close with because we mutually hated the same person when we first became friends.
Okay.
So it's a strong bonding experience, is what I can say.
Yes, I guess. I don't know if that's been like the crux of what I formed friendships around ever.
Oh, I can think of at least two, probably more friendships based on that. And like people I still talk to on a regular basis nowadays. And like the people we dislike aren't in our lives anymore. So our friendships have grown exponentially beyond that. But it was a good like lightning rod to bring me together with some of my friends.
Well, and I think that that's a really interesting highlighting of why Lizzie and Wickham wouldn't have actually worked, is because the thing that they talk about and bond over, that's almost the only thing they think about and bond over, is Darcy.
Right, they don't expand upon their relationship in other ways after that.
They're not talking about music, they're not talking about books, they're gossiping about Darcy, and that's the main crux of what they talk about all the time.
Yeah, I don't think they would have a lifelong friendship or companionship for Wickham and Lizzie for many reasons. And then we find out about the ball that's going to happen at Netherfield. Hurrah.
Hurrah!
And poor Lizzie having to dance with Collins. I did have a question for you.
Okay.
So, for people who are not listening to our season two, we've been reading Northanger Abbey, and we just put out an episode all about dancing and fidelity. And so, I had this curiosity of in Pride and Prejudice, and I don't know what the timeline difference is between Pride and Prejudice and Northanger, but in Pride and Prejudice, it seems to be that two dances is the like, oh, commitment. Oh, you danced a lot together versus in Northanger where they dance all night together. So what's the difference? Why is that different in the gravity and appeal?
Oh, so they don't dance all night together in Northanger.
Really?
No, they don't. If you can recall, even in what we've already read, that Thorpe was supposed to dance with Catherine. They did dance. She finished and went to look for Mr. Tilney to dance, and he had danced with someone else.
Yeah, but then couldn't they have danced together later in the night? We talk about Tilney being a very loyal dance companion.
Because he attends to her for tea time, because he was her partner directly before tea.
I see. Okay. I thought it was a like you were making a commitment to dance all night.
No, just for the dance. And there's the reason that it's two dances come in sets, and there's a very specific way that dances get outlined. But if you dance more than one set with someone, that would be like dancing the whole night with someone. Not quite, but that would be considered someone showing a preference, which would show a desire for a deeper commitment and that it's being publicly shown. So that's why Isabella and Catherine's brother James dancing together more than once is like intimate. And the dances are very different because Netherfield is a ball, whereas the dances in Bath, there's special etiquette to all of the timing and stuff around that.
Right. I guess, yeah, those events maybe are a little bit different too, because it's like a many nights of the week type thing versus like, oh, this is a special thing we're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. It had struck me because we had recently talked about dancing and fidelity and commitment. And so to have Collins ask Lizzie to dance two dances, although I already knew that was big in Pride and Prejudice world, I was trying to extrapolate it to like Northanger world, and if that also would relate, and it sounds like it does.
So when he says the first two dances, that's like the set.
Got it. Oh, poor Lizzie.
Yeah.
I will say before we get to the dance, Mrs. Bennet is a real mean mom in this, being like, you'll never be as pretty as your sister Jane. But then I wrote down many times after this point, run, Lizzie, run, just run away and hide. I really wanted the like 2005 version of Lizzie hiding from Collins at this dance versus having to actually dance with him, which I know is not how it is in the book, but it's what I wanted because I just don't want Collins to be around. I want him to go away.
He's so creepy.
He's so creepy.
When Mrs. Bennet says that Jane's taken, and then they camera pan to all the other daughters before he's like, that one. It's like mission seeking out a target. It's so Ugh.
But that's the epitome of Collins. Like, he came there with a mission of, I'm going to marry one of these girls. And in all honesty, I don't think Collins can tell the difference between any of them. I think he is just like, cool, you pick the oldest. Okay, the oldest isn't available. We'll pick the next oldest. And maybe she's a little less objectionable than her sisters, who are maybe a little more annoying.
Well, and young. We'll throw Colin some credit that he's not a creeper like Wickham. He's a creeper in a very different way.
Yes. Okay. And here's the other thing I will throw him some credit for. His hat is better than the hats that Bingley and Darcy were wearing in episode one.
Okay. So you don't mind his hat?
No, because his hat is normal. It's not a weird, I don't even know how to describe those hats, but it is a normal hat. And so I could appreciate that his hat at least was better. That's my one plus for Collins in this episode, is he has a better, less silly hat.
Okay. He's got an okay hat.
Yeah, that's about all I got. I will say, when they are walking into the ball, Jane does look particularly beautiful with, like, she's got the hood up on her cloak and she does look quite lovely. I was like, yeah, I guess in this moment, like, she does kind of look nicer than Lizzie, but I like this Jane and I like this Bingley together.
They're cute.
They're so cute. And Bingley is such a puppy.
And they're calm.
Yeah. And like, he's so smiley and he seems to really be doing in this version, really doing his part to be a good host, to be kind to Lizzie.
I feel like this one is a little less of an airhead.
Yes, he is very joyous, but maybe less puppy, or maybe less chaotic puppy.
So kind of like 2005 version is a puppy and 1995 version is a golden retriever grown up.
Yeah, a little calmer, a little more settled into who he is, but still lots of joy.
Yeah, he's predisposed for optimism and kindness.
Yep. I also thought we had talked about how Carolyn and Mrs. Hurst's clothing in episode one made them like really stand out quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And although they are still a little bit out there, it feels less. And some of me wonders if that's like an intentional choice to narrate that, like, they've been in town for about a month, so they're getting a sense of like, oh, like, this is kind of the style and the tones and the things that people are wearing here, versus on their very first night when they dressed maybe a little bit more London fashion.
Maybe. I also think there's a piece of it that is everybody else is more dressed up because it's a ball. Fancy, fancy.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't considered it going the other way, but that does make sense. And then, well, Collins just won't shut up. And I just tell him many times in my notes to shut up. When he starts talking to Carolyn, I wrote down, run, Lizzie, he's distracted.
Yeah, I mean, showing the courtesy of not abandoning Carolyn to him.
Yeah, I guess she's nice.
Well, and trying not to be super embarrassed because he is attached to their family.
Right, yeah, he is their cousin. And then we see Darcy. And he's just staring very intensely, presumably at Lizzie, but the way the shots are done are kind of into the camera. And part of it looks like he's in pain a little bit.
Like, there's a lot of like brow furrowing.
Yeah. And we had at the end of last episode, a little bit of like Darcy's, oh, I'm in love face when he's watching Lizzie play with the giant dog.
Right.
This face does not feel like an, oh, I'm in love. This feels like I'm like trying to figure out how to do my taxes and concentrating very purposefully. And it's not easy and it's very hard and stressful. Maybe it looks like a stress look and painful.
And you can tell me what you think. I wonder if that is Darcy's experience of love. Darcy's experience of love is like, for neurotypicals, doing taxes. He's probably great at taxes. That probably would not stress him out at all. But all of a sudden, he's got feelings and he's trying to probably approach it like taxes, which explains his stuff later down the line, and think about it and evaluate her. And he's super concentrating on that.
It's not a bad explanation. And when we do get to the two of them dancing together and Lizzie's like, okay, we're supposed to talk. And he's quite silent to start with. I mean, not that he engages a lot in the conversation as a whole, but I did write down, oh, poor Darcy. He's probably concentrating very hard and Lizzie wants to talk. And I just imagine him being like, I'm trying to count my steps so I don't mess up this dance. I am thinking about all the feelings and things rushing around inside of me. And now you want me to respond to you and say things? This is a lot of work all at once.
I don't know if Darcy, I think he's a good dancer. I don't know how much he would have to concentrate on that. But I think in the book, you kind of get this impression that he's like, oh, we both like silence.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
This is so comfortable. And in this, he does not seem comfortable.
No, he seems so uncomfortable in this. But what I also realized is Darcy also thinks this is very flirty with Lizzie, that he thinks she is maybe also reciprocating some of these feelings. And so like Darcy's barometer is real off on everything.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what happened in his life that he feels like anger and sarcasm are flirtatious.
Right? Yeah, where does that come from? Poor Darcy.
He likes to be told off.
Yeah, he does. He does. Oh, Darcy.
But I will say that when I was watching it, there's like one moment where she's dancing with Collins, where he kind of like breaks a smile. And I think that was like the moment where he was evaluating how she deals with difficult situations. But when they were dancing together, I didn't feel bad for him. And I don't think you're supposed to, because you're supposed to think that he's a prideful ass. He kind of is. But the look on his face, the constipation and concentration, made me think, why did you choose to dance with her if you're just going to be angry the whole time, dude?
Right. Like, why does he even ask her if it's not going to be an enjoyable experience?
It's so weird.
Yeah. Why is he putting himself through that pain?
And you, like, maybe he's doing that because he wants to show her that he's interested, but it never seemed this painful in the book. Awkward? Not his usual? Yes. Painful?
And the 2005 movie version, this does not seem as painful. They make it like weird in other ways, but it's not painful.
They dialed up the awkward.
Yes.
In 2005, I feel like. And I feel like in 1995, they dialed up the anger.
I think both, though. I think this is both angry and awkward.
So Colin Firth is the angry, awkward Darcy.
Yes. That's what we branded him.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they stop dancing. Everyone's kind of like sitting down, eating, talking, playing cards. And poor Mary has to play the piano. And you're just left feeling bad for her the entire time. And Lizzie says it at some point of like, but she is determined to play. And I think that that is like a nice redeeming quality of Mary's, is even if she's not the best, she clearly finds joy in this and feels very proud about this and wants to do this. Good for her. Follow your heart, Mary. You do you.
I guess so. But she also isn't very good and doesn't seem to try to get better.
Yeah, but does that matter? Does she have to be good to enjoy it? Granted, maybe she's not enjoying it.
But my point is, Mary's doing this at a public event at someone else's house. It's one thing when she's doing it at her aunt's. It's another thing when she takes a spot from someone who is better than her to show off in this very public setting. There's a piece of that where it's selfish, even if she's doing it because she wants to do it.
Right. There's not a self-awareness to it.
Well, and also, like, if you want to do that, practice and get a tutor and be better.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of this Mary, if I'm honest. Like, she's a little bit sadder. She's a little more awkward. I just don't know what to make of her.
This Mary feels much more accurate to me to the Mary that's in the books, who's like constantly moralizing and stepping in to be like, that person did something wrong, making herself the center of attention, even though she's not great at things. It's one thing to play and then yield the floor, but she doesn't want to yield.
Right. And her father has to go and stop her.
Right.
Yeah. I can't tell how I feel about this Mary. I feel sad for her. I can't tell if I like her or not. I think I pity her.
Do you like Book Mary?
No, but I don't think Book Mary really made a difference.
Very background.
Yeah. The book probably could have gone on without Mary.
Well, and if you remember, this moment is specifically to show that the Bennets are super embarrassing in public.
Oh, yeah. You get the pan around of Mrs. Bennet being really loud and gossipy and Lydia and Kitty running around and stealing swords. And you get that feeling of like, oh, God, this family's so embarrassing.
Right.
Which we know to be quite true and to be one of Darcy's many complaints.
Yeah. And you get Lizzie's sort of mortification. Jane's too. How did you feel about Mrs. Hurst kind of taking over and being like, this is how you play piano?
I mean, I think it's a bit of a dick move, but she's also quite good. I do think it's funny that Collins like kind of gets up to be like, I'm going to sing. And then she's like, nope, I'm playing a song you cannot sing to. I am done with this family.
What did you think of Colin and Darcy's meeting?
So while I was watching it, I was like, I just envision Collins being the person who has really bad breath and is a close talker, because he gets really up and close and personal to Darcy. And I just imagine him being the person who has really bad breath that you want to get away from, but they like won't step away and they won't give you your personal bubble space.
So that's why Darcy gets up and walks away.
I mean, I did write down, we should all deal with Collins the way that Darcy did, which is get up and just walk away.
What is your name, sir? And as he's answering, just turns around and leaves.
Right? And is like, I don't give a fuck about who you are. Go away.
There was also a part of me that's like, oh, Collins is overstepping, but also like, Darcy, that's really rude.
It's super rude. It's super rude. And if it was done to any other character, I'd be really mad about it. And I'd be like, come on, Darcy, like, you don't have to be an asshole. But it's done to Collins, who I just hate him so much that I don't care.
Yeah. I also wonder if there's like this little moment for Darcy where he's like, oh, you're from Lady Catherine. And he doesn't actually like his aunt that much. She's an obligation. And so he doesn't have a problem insulting this person.
Well, and I wonder if some of it too is he's like, I know Lady Catherine really likes me. So it doesn't actually fucking matter what I do, because she's not going to stop liking me if you go back and say like, your nephew was a jerk. Also, you're never going to say that about me.
Yeah. I don't know if Darcy read the social situation that much, or if he was just like, how do I get away from this?
I'm just going to get up and walk away.
Yeah. And then he walks over to Caroline and Louisa and just kind of like makes a sound of like.
And then they eventually go home, which is good. It was interesting because they didn't show that the Bennet family was there way too long, which I think because they had done such a good job being like, oh, the Bennet family is such a mess already. It might have been too much for the episode to be like, oh, God, now they're waiting. This is horrible.
Yeah, the Bingleys just being like, okay, it was good to have you. You need to go.
Please leave. And then we get to Collins's proposal. And I actually, so when it was coming, I did a time check and there was about 10 minutes left in the episode. And I was like, damn it. I thought we would have finished this episode before this happened. I just don't want to watch this. And all I wrote was, nope, 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 nope.
So because I've seen this multiple times and it is a gross scene, I was paying attention to different things in the scene, like the pieces of art that were on the walls. I appreciated Lizzie's reactions, specifically at the start where she's just like laughing at him openly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard scene.
Yeah, the very start of that scene, there's a vase on the table with flowers in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Lizzie kind of like steps around it and puts it in between them.
Yes.
Which I think is like a very interesting set design piece to it. But I did write down, throw the vase at him and run! Run away!
So I picked up on that too. And it, for me, represents the fact that Collins isn't a safe person. And Lizzie senses this and tried to put as much distance between them as she could politely.
Yes, and physical barrier. And his proposal's just gross. And again, I have that thing where like this Collins talks and I can't hear what he's saying. He sounds like the Charlie Brown teacher to me. It does not register for me. So all I wrote was his proposal is gross. I just can't process it.
I think you really get the sense of how many times Lee has to turn him down and he's still continuing to propose and then threaten her. Feels very accurate to book Collins.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I do think it feels very accurate to the book.
This had much of the incel-y vibes.
I think, yeah, incel-y, and I wrote down, he's a man who clearly has never had a woman say no to him.
I don't know if he's a man who's talked to many women.
I mean, yes, I don't think he's talked to a lot of women in his life. And he clearly views women as property or a means to an end. But he seems so boldly shocked that she would even consider saying no to him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the woman that he talks to the most is Lady Catherine. And Lady Catherine has basically talked him up a long time now, being like, you're a catch.
Right. And been like, anyone will be lucky to have you because you're connected to me.
Ugh. Yeah. And he just doesn't understand how Lizzie could be like, no.
I will say this is my favorite Mr. Bennett moment of all Mr. Bennett moments, when he makes this speech of like, from this point on, you will be without one parent. Your mother, if you say no, and me, if you say yes. He says it slightly differently than that. But that's the gist of it.
Yes. Do you want to know what he says?
I mean, I know what he says. I just can't remember the exact words. But if you want to say the exact words, go for it.
I don't know if I'll be exact, but you have a terrible choice before you, Lizzie. Your mother says she will never speak to you again if you don't marry Mr. Collins. And I will never speak to you again if you do.
Oh, Mr. Bennett! That's my favorite Mr. Bennett moment in all of Pride and Prejudice.
What are you thinking of this Mr. Bennett?
I think he feels close to the book, Mr. Bennett.
Yeah.
I still hold this thing of like, I know there are lots of people out there who really like Mr. Bennett. And I think there are things that are likable about him. I don't necessarily think that makes him a great parent.
Okay. Do you think he's a more likable character in this version, in the book, or is it 2005?
I don't know. I don't know if I have an answer to that yet.
Because compared to like 2005, we don't see him consoling Mary or like being super involved in their lives. When Mrs. Bennett comes to tell him that Collins has proposed to Lizzie, he's like, what is going on?
But also a little bit like, what does this have to do with me? I think the jury's still out on this one for me. I don't know.
Okay.
I'll keep you posted. We'll follow up on that. I think some of it is because I know what comes. I'm interested to see how they play the Lizzie being like, don't let our sister go off to be with these older men. This is a bad idea. I'm interested to see how this one plays his reaction to that.
Okay.
I will let you know. I will keep you posted.
Yeah.
And as always, Mrs. Bennett, very dramatic. We end on her just like wailing.
Oh, yeah. Do you like the moment when Charlotte's coming over and they like pause and like Charlotte just stands there for a second and thinks that's the moment that Charlotte was like, I can hook him?
I mean, yeah, I think that maybe. I don't know. I was a little sad that Lizzie's the one who introduces them.
Hmm.
I don't know if it felt as calculated in it, like when I watched it, but maybe. I think it'll depend how we see their relationship develop. I don't know if she's just like, cool, maybe I'll be nice to my friend and get this creepy guy out of her house. Or if she's like, well, if Lizzie doesn't want him, I'll take him.
Right. Well, you also have to remember she's 27 and Lizzie's 21, 20.
I'd say of the two episodes we've watched so far, I liked the first episode better. But I think my dislike for this episode comes from Collins.
Which is fair.
Yeah. So when we get past all the Collins content, I'll probably start liking the miniseries better.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's a decent amount of Collins content left.
I know. It makes me sad.
But this feels like very appropriate book-wise to how much you hated Collins.
Yes. And I do think this feels much more accurate to the book than the movie did. And just pacing-wise feels a little bit easier to watch.
Well, they're just very different formats, right?
I'm liking it. I think I will end up liking the miniseries better than the movie.
We'll see. Maybe like after we're done this, we'll have to go back and watch the movie so that you can have had the experience of watching the miniseries before watching the movie and see if it shifts any things for you where you're like, oh, I understand why they cut that, and see if maybe the movie feels less weird.
No, I think that movie's always going to feel weird. Yeah, that movie's just weird, Kate.
Yeah. Can you remember any moments of it that you liked?
Yeah, I liked the dancing. There was good dancing in it. I really like Keira Knightley. I thought she was a great Lizzie.
What do you think of Jennifer Ely?
I like Jennifer Ely. I think she's great. I think she's also an excellent Lizzie. I think they're very different Lizzies. I think they tap into different energies as Lizzie.
That's fair.
But in ways that still feel very true to the character.
Okay. I appreciate that the last two episodes have started with Lizzie walking. Both movie and miniseries are like, she walks a lot. She walks a lot.
Yes. It is a very important point to her character. She's a walker. It is very cute.
Any other thoughts?
I don't think so. I mean, it'll be interesting. Got, what, 4 more episodes left? Because there's 6 total.
Yeah.
So it'll just be interesting to see how that develops. And we'll keep interspersing these episodes in between our Northanger content. I do think as we get through Northanger, it'll be interesting to see how that impacts my interpretation of Pride and Prejudice also.
Yeah. I mean, it might not at all. They're different books.
It's hard not to compare a Darcy to a Tilney. So I'll be interested to see what I think of both of them by the end of this, or if those parallels keep coming up.
So like content wise, we're probably as far through Northanger as we are through the miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you like better, Tilney or Darcy?
Well, of course, Tilney. I mean, Darcy's an ass up until this point so far. If I didn't know how Darcy turns out and know more about Darcy, straight comparison one-to-one, Tilney is by far a more likable character.
Okay.
I think as a whole, I'm probably on Team Darcy, but what I'll say is I think I already know Darcy will not be my favorite Jane Austen hero.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who do you think will be your favorite Jane Austen hero?
I don't know, but I don't know if it's Darcy.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Oh, my brain's going through the books to see if there's anybody. We got Darcy and Tilney.
Well, don't tell me.
Well, I named the first two and then I'm thinking about the other ones. And I gotta say, I don't know. We'll see.
Am I gonna hate all the rest of them?
I don't think you'll hate them. I guess for me, the Jane Austen hero and the Jane Austen heroine that you love the best says a lot about you. And I'll be very interested to see what your type is.
Are you putting me as a Lizzie and Darcy?
I mean, I'm hopeful that you're a Tilney like me. Like, I don't know how to tell you anything without spoiling it, but don't get me wrong. There are people who don't like Tilney or well, it's not that they don't like Tilney or Darcy. They're just lower on their list. So maybe you'll like one of the other heroes a little bit better.
There we go. We'll just have to wait and see on that.
Yeah. Now it's making me curious about which one we're going to read next because I want to figure out your type. I am so excited for you to continue Northanger Abbey. So if people aren't listening, you should definitely tune in. Teresa's getting very much into the spirit of the book.
Yeah, everyone's a murderer.
Make sure you're listening to that too.
All right. Well, any other thoughts from you?
This is just a really annoying episode that you have to get through to get to the rest of the content. I feel like there's a lot of good character building content in this episode, specifically around Wickham and Darcy. And then you have Collins, which I think you're right. You don't need to listen to anything Collins says in order for the story to move forward. So yeah, there's a lot of like shrillness, I think, in this episode.
And I think that's actually probably pretty accurate for how I felt reading the book.
Yes.
Like this felt like the part of the book that you just have to get through to get to the other stuff.
You were really excited for the ball, but I feel like the ball in this kind of gets swept over. It's not as big as it is in the book.
Yeah, the ball in the book was better. Although I liked the dancing and they did spend a lot of time dancing in this one. So I enjoyed that. Well, I guess we will keep interspersing these with our other content from Northanger.
Thanks for listening.
If you want to follow us on social media, you can follow Kate's meme account at Austen Therapy on Instagram and our podcast account at Austen Therapy Podcast on Instagram.
We really appreciate when everyone shares and likes our stuff. And we're really glad that you're coming on this journey with us.
We'll see you next time.
Bye. Bye.